Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an overview of America's long and losing wars in the Middle East that are still ongoing, now well into their fourth decade, and speak with Andrew Bacevich, a retired U.S. Army colonel and professor of history and international relations at Boston University, who previously taught at West Point. He joins us to discuss how, from the end of World War II until 1980, virtually no American soldiers were killed in action while serving in the Middle East, whereas since 1990, virtually no American soldiers have been killed in action anywhere else. And since we are still bogged down in wars that not only have we not won and are not winning, now in this presidential election, candidates are calling on us to double down and try harder in a call to arms, which is highly unlikely to produce a different outcome. Then we will speak with Matt Engel, who directs the Texas Democratic Trust and the Lone Star Project, a political action committee that aims to be an aggressive fact-checker on the Republican Party. He joins us to discuss the GOP establishment's desperate embrace of the highly polarizing and extraordinarily untested and inexperienced candidate Ted Cruz, who, after getting elected as the junior senator from Texas based on as few people as possible turning out to vote, is now being backed by the Republican Party and its big donors, not because he is the preferred candidate, but because he is not Donald Trump. And since a brokered Republican convention is becoming more and more likely, we will look into the possibility that Cruz might turn out to be a stalking horse for the more electable Paul Ryan. And joining us now is Andrew Bacevich, who's a retired professor of history and international relations at Boston University, who previously taught at West Point and Johns Hopkins University. A graduate of the U.S. Military Academy, he served for 23 years as a commissioned officer in the United States Army and is the author of the New York Times bestsellers Breach of Trust, Washington Rules, and The Limits of Power. His latest book just out is America's War for the Greater Middle East, A Military History. Welcome to Background Briefing, Andrew Bacevich.
Thanks very much.
And it's, I think most of our audience probably may not be aware that we've been involved in the Middle East now. We're into our fourth decade. And it's extraordinary to think, as you point out in your book, that from the end of World War II until 1980, virtually no American soldiers were killed in action while serving in the Greater Middle East. But since 1990, virtually no American soldiers have been killed in action anywhere else. So that reminds me of that Rudyard Kipling couplet about the gravestone in Afghanistan. Here lies the fool who tried to hustle the East.
Oh, yes. Well, I mean, I think in some senses the point of the book is twofold. The first is to provide a historical account that traces this experience, this military experience, which has been going on for several decades now. We Americans, I think, tend to have sort of historical amnesia and think that the only thing that matters is what's happened in the last day and a half. So to provide the historical account, and secondly, then to invite the readers to reflect on what has been accomplished and where things are headed. From my own point of view, almost nothing that we've accomplished has been positive, and there is really no clear sense of where we're headed. We're stuck in a condition of permanent war, and I think most Americans should find that to be unsatisfactory.
Well, but in the context of the obvious fact that we haven't won a war since World War II, what is the rationale for war in the sense that you don't have victory parades anymore? So it's very hard to understand why we could be in a permanent war without victory.
Well, I think the rationale for this war, in a sense, is twofold. The first is it began as a war for oil. It began in 1980 when Jimmy Carter promulgated the Carter Doctrine. The Carter Doctrine declared the Persian Gulf a vital U.S. national security interest. Why did he do that? Because at that point, the U.S., our own prosperity was increasingly dependent upon access to Persian Gulf oil, and the region had been destabilized by two events, the Iranian Revolution and the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. So it began as a war for oil, but I think it quickly morphed into something quite different. It became a war to affirm American exceptionalism. It became a war to demonstrate that the United States need not abide by the limits imposed on other countries. And a succession of American presidents persuaded themselves that by using American military power in the region, that we can impose our will. We could dominate. We could transform. We could shape. In crudest terms, we could show that we were in charge. But to examine the narrative, the unfolding saga of U.S. military activities in the region is to see clearly that those expectations have never been fulfilled.
Well, in terms of what you've just told us, Andrew Bacevich, one would assume then that perhaps the deployment in Beirut in 1983 was the beginning of this tragedy and this sort of, you know, unending quagmire, if you will.
That was one of the very first episodes, and upon reflection, it's a very telling episode. It was informed by a lack of clear understanding of what was going on in Lebanon, meaning that the policymakers in the Reagan administration, who thought that sending peacekeepers to Lebanon would be a good idea, they simply didn't understand the circumstance. And what was equally instructive is their assumption that by their mere presence, these American Marines would somehow ease tensions, bring about some sort of political resolution, when in fact putting the Marines on the ground simply made them into targets and ultimately cost the lives of 241 Marines killed in a single day.
And then was quickly followed by the invasion of Grenada, which was a form of distraction, and as many have argued. Again, I'm speaking with Andrew Bacevich, a retired professor of history and international relations at Boston University. He previously taught at West Point and Johns Hopkins University, a graduate of the U.S. Military Academy. He served for 23 years as a commissioned officer in the United States Army, and is the author of the New York Times bestsellers Breach of Trust, Washington Rules, and The Limits of Power. His latest book just out is America's War for the Greater Middle East, A Military History. But when you, as you just said, we become targets, that seems to be, you know, almost as though we're reenacting the Crusades, that by just showing up in Muslim lands, it seems that we create, well, in the case of George W. Bush and the post 9/11, he effectively simply swallowed bin Laden's bait. I mean, bin Laden was trying to justify his serial attacks on the United States based upon the idea that the Crusaders were going to come and take your land and take your oil. Well, didn't George W. Bush fulfill that sort of the worst fantasies of bin Laden?
Well, I think he did. I mean, obviously not intentionally, because George W. Bush's assessment of the situation was quite different. His assessment was radically defective, radically wrong. But I do think that George W. Bush genuinely believed, or at least had genuinely persuaded himself, that the invasion of Iraq was going to bring about not simply deposing Saddam Hussein, but that would rapidly bring about the transformation of Iraq into some sort of a stable, more or less liberal, more or less democratic, more or less pro-Western country. That didn't come to pass. Instead, Iraq blew up in our faces, and that is further demonstration, if we needed it, as to the astonishing naivete of American policymakers as they have considered how to employ force in this region. But, you know, you can't just blame George W. Bush. We can look at the record of the present administration, the overthrow of Muammar Gaddafi in 2011, which President Obama certainly signed off on, and Secretary Clinton certainly forcefully advocated. That produced as negative consequences as did the 2003 invasion of Iraq. So the point is, this is not an issue of, you know, one party behaves stupidly and the other party behaves intelligently. There's been plenty of stupidity to go around.
Well, having, as you did, Colonel Bezovich, served in Vietnam, a lot of the questions that the troops were asking was, why are we there? And the answers weren't particularly good or particularly coherent or particularly convincing. And is that the same situation that we have now in Afghanistan and in Iraq? And if indeed we go with more boots on the ground against ISIS or Daesh, it seems, if you go back to what we were talking about a minute ago, the Beirut bombings of 83, they were fiendishly effective, that we become bait and targets. And I was just watching this HBO documentary by Michael Ware about the battles of Fallujah and Ramadi. And I'm sure you've seen the documentaries about the battles up on the border with Afghanistan and Pakistan, Restrepo. You just get this idea, the ferocity of these constant attacks, and usually our boys are outnumbered, and they've got a lot of firepower, but they're constantly being attacked, and the immediate conclusion you come to is, my God, these guys that are attacking us are incredibly motivated. They know what they want, and that's where the asymmetrical warfare seems to be, is that our guys don't know exactly why they're there. But those people sure as hell know why they want us not to be there.
Well, here's where I think the Vietnam comparison breaks down. And in a way, you put your finger on it, that when, as the Vietnam War evolved, and by the time we got to 1967, certainly 1968, some considerable number of Americans were posing some very fundamental questions, like, why are we there? And, you know, is this war a doomed effort? And those questions tend not to be posed about our military engagement in the Islamic world. In that regard, the only questions that get asked have to do with the events of the moment. So in the current presidential campaign, there's been a certain amount of posturing by candidates about how they would deal with ISIS if elected as president. But there's been virtually no serious consideration about the larger war, about what U.S. military actions in Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, Lebanon, Somalia, the Balkans, and so on, what those efforts have yielded over the course of several decades, and therefore what those experiences, how those experiences should bear on policy decisions going forward. So as far as the presidential candidates are concerned, it's as if virtually nothing has happened prior to roughly 2014 and 2015.
Well, I think your point's well taken. Of course, the 9/11 attacks have been cited as justification. But it is clearly, when you think about the current presidential races, my God, some of the stuff the candidates are saying is just so appalling, with Ted Cruz talking about making the sand glow in the Middle East and Donald Trump hiring a bunch of nobodies as his national security team, including a U.S. general who worked for Paul Bremer at the time when the U.S. made the most catastrophic mistakes in the so-called Green Zone.
It does not give you much confidence about what we would get if either of those gentlemen were elected president.
And on the other side, what do you take from Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders?
Well, I think Secretary Clinton is basically an unrepentant hawk. She does not seem to be a person who is capable of thinking critically about old habits or first principles. I think Senator Sanders of the remaining candidates is the one candidate who may be capable of thinking creatively about U.S. policy, but that's not really the cornerstone of his candidacy. I mean, he is about economic inequality. He's about social injustice. So he has not really spelled out in very great detail what a Bernie Sanders approach to the world would look like. I myself would like to hear more from him in that regard, because I think that he's the one guy who potentially has the capacity to stimulate a serious debate over foreign policy, and we need that debate.
We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back continuing the conversation with Andrew Bacevich.
This is a war we can win. After 10,000 years, it's still us against them, and my heroes have always died at the end. So who's going to account for these sins? And I don't know.
Oh no, oh well, I ain't gonna study war no more. Ain't gonna study war no more. Ain't gonna study.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And we're continuing the conversation with Andrew Bacevich, who's a retired professor of history and international relations at Boston University, who previously taught at West Point and Johns Hopkins University. A graduate of the U.S. Military Academy, he served for 23 years as a commissioned officer in the United States Army, and is the author of the New York Times bestsellers Breach of Trust, Washington Rules, and The Limits of Power. His latest book just out is America's War for the Greater Middle East, A Military History. Do you think, though, Colonel Bacevich, that within this incoherent and embarrassingly vapid presidential campaign vis-a-vis foreign policy, not to mention the paucity in terms of the domestic policy, apart from, you know, squabbles and insults, my sense is that on Bernie Sanders' side, he's got Representative Tulsi Gabbard, who's a vet from Iraq and Afghanistan, and she's still very angry at Hillary Clinton about her vote on the Iraq war. And on the Republican side, for all of his manifest faults, the one thing that Donald Trump seems to be contributing is he's telling the truth about the folly of the Iraq war and the fact that the architects of it should be held responsible. Obviously, when he was running against Jeb Bush, he was going after Bush via trashing his brother.
You're making a truly valid point. It's the absence of accountability that, you know, people should be hung by their thumbs and publicly humiliated. But accountability in the sense of getting to the truth of why decisions were made and how they were done and who was giving what advice and who was making what decisions. The eagerness of the Washington establishment to let bygones be bygones, and therefore you're right, to have the same talking heads still appearing on television is appalling. But I think in considerable part because that establishment only nominally breaks into opposing Republican and Democratic wings, but actually adheres to a entrenched consensus about how the United States is supposed to behave, there simply is no willingness to examine in any kind of depth the causes of failure. There is simply the determination to press on as if failure hadn't occurred, and to some degree, we the people let them get away with it by not insisting upon the kind of accountability I described.
Well, there's a lot of talk about the angry white men that are flocking to support Donald Trump, and the reasons are the downsizing, the outsourcing, the trade, the bad trade deals, all of which he pounds away on. But my understanding is that also a part of that constituency are the veterans who have done the heavy lifting in Iraq and Afghanistan and are very bitter about what happened to them, and they have every reason to be bitter, surely. Is that your understanding, that in that constituency that Donald Trump's bringing out, there are an awful lot of vets?
I don't know enough about it.
Right.
I mean, I do know because I've received communications from veterans that within that community there certainly are some people who are angry and bitter, who feel misused. But I don't know enough to say whether that constitutes, 5% of the veteran population or 75%.
Well, it's just so odd that we always say, at least our politicians always say there's nothing too good for the vets, but then we don't really hear from the vets, and they don't, once they've done the wars and come home, they kind of tend to try and forget them. And there's no question that some of the stuff that's going on now with the VA is just so appalling. It's just cruel and unusual that so many vets are being characterized as having personality disorders, and they get dishonorable discharges,
right,
which then means that the government, Uncle Sam's obligation, is out the window, that they don't get the benefits from the VA that they should be getting for PTSD and other things that, they, in other words, the PTSD is being characterized as a personality disorder, for God's sake.
Yeah, there's a yawning gap between the rhetoric of support the vets and support the troops and the reality of the way they're treated. And it's a puzzle. I mean, big government bureaucracies, I suppose any big government bureaucracy harbors inefficiencies, perhaps tends to be slow. But why the VA seems to be so uniquely dysfunctional, relative to other cabinet agencies, is certainly a puzzle. Because there is this contradiction, as you suggested, between what we say we owe to veterans and the way they are actually treated.
Well, it's a sort of metaphor, I guess, is that Wounded Warrior Project, that was tugging at the heartstrings, and it turns out that the people in charge were feathering their own nests in an obscene way.
Yeah, but that wasn't the government.
Of course it wasn't.
That was a bunch of cynical and corrupt people who behaved despicably.
But it shows you how much the public really do value veterans and how the rhetoric can be exploited. And
yes, it does. Correct. Yes, I agree.
So let's then turn to your book again, America's War for the Greater Middle East, A Military History, Andrew Bacevich. And I guess in many ways, when you read your book, you think, well, for all of his faults, at least Obama is not trying to get us into another war. And he's, of course, the critics are piling on that he leads from behind, and now somehow, and maybe there's some evidence to this, somehow, Russia's now taking the lead, and we've lost our position in the world, et cetera, et cetera. A lot of that, and frankly, if you read the interview that Obama did with the Atlantic, for example, the red line that he crossed, that Assad was supposed to have crossed with the sarin attack, Obama mentions that the intelligence wasn't a slam dunk. Now there are reports coming out of Turkey that maybe the Turkish intelligence service had somehow got some sarin in there, and given it to Daesh, etc. So how do you rate the fact that Obama, unlike his predecessors, have at least tried to get us out of wars?
Well, President Obama, like his predecessor, like his predecessor's predecessor, came to office knowing next to nothing about statecraft. I mean, we have this strange tradition of electing novices to be commander-in-chief, so that with the expectation that this is a job they can master while they're in office. My judgment of President Obama would be that when he entered office, he was remarkably naive about our capacity to act in the world. He probably was to some degree seduced by all the people surrounding him, telling him that he was a great historic figure. But I believe, and this is very clear in the Atlantic essay that you referred to, what's clear to me is that over time he has acquired a substantial education in statecraft and has today quite a sophisticated understanding of the world and our place in it, and has come to be quite appropriately skeptical about what he calls, I think, the rule book, Washington's rule book, of the way U.S. policy is to be conducted. So he does not genuflect at these truisms that TV personalities or people aspiring to high office so frequently spout in order to try to demonstrate their grasp of foreign policy. So I think he's learned a lot. Where the president perhaps has not done as well is in acting on those perceptions. So he has not committed any blunders comparable to those of George W. Bush in invading Iraq. But that said, we haven't gotten out of Iraq where we got out, and now we're stuck in it again. We have not ended the Afghanistan war. The president has, in fact, initiated several new fronts, if you want to call it that, in the war on terror, Libya, Yemen, and so on. So his record has tended to be mixed at this point.
Again, I'm speaking with Andrew Bacevich, a retired professor of history and international relations at Boston University. He previously taught at West Point and Johns Hopkins University, a graduate of the U.S. Military Academy. He served for 23 years as a commissioned officer in the United States Army and is the author of the New York Times bestsellers Breach of Trust, Washington Rules, and The Limits of Power. His latest book just out is America's War for the Greater Middle East, A Military History. But isn't there a kind of strange paradox, though, that we are the most powerful military state in the history of the world? I think we outspend the top 10 other rivals, many of whom are allies, combined. And we're spending more today on defense than we spent during the Cold War. And yet we have such a sort of amorphous enemy. And then when we use military power, we tend to get bogged down and trapped. And one of the things I find incredibly ironic is that one of the most effective instruments now of state power are sanctions. And it's as though the Treasury Department has more clout in many ways of solving the problems of the 21st century geopolitical landscape than the Pentagon does.
Well, I'm not sure I'm totally enamored with sanctions, but to the larger point you're making, sometime around the end of the Cold War, we, the people, and also our foreign policy establishment, became so utterly enamored with military power as our supposed strong suit that we have forfeited the capacity to think critically about military power, to be able to differentiate between what it can do and what it can't do. And so there is this blind blundering on, especially in the Islamic world, even though the historical record is abundantly clear that the use of American military power to try to somehow shape or salvage that region has been simply counterproductive. It's cost us, it's cost people who live in that part of the world, and it has produced next to nothing that is positive.
Well, just in the current environment, where just last week there was the release of the Panama Papers, and people suddenly were aware of the fact that the global elite of celebrities, politicians, and business moguls, their ill-gotten gains are being commingled with the worst dictators in the world. And that brings me back at least to the notion that if you look at all the wars since the end of the Cold War, starting with the first, which was in Panama, we sent the military in to arrest one man, Noriega, and there was collateral damage. In the case of Saddam Hussein, we sent the military in with enormous collateral damage just to get one guy effectively. And we have the same problems with Sudan and all of these. And by the way, he had his money in the Panamanian bank too. So it seems to me that maybe that's a better way to handle. When I was talking about how the Treasury maybe has more clout, it seems that it's so dysfunctional to go to war to depose a dictator who, by and large, the real results are that we either destroy the country or kill thousands of the inhabitants of that country whose only crime is that they lived under a dictatorship. And I guess you could hold up Libya as a prime example of that.
Well, I mean, I agree with you. I mean, that there is this tendency to personalize the problem, that the problem is Saddam Hussein or Gaddafi or Mohammed Farah Aidid down there in Somalia, or the Serb dictator. It is a way of simplifying the actual problem, so as to facilitate action, inevitably military action, but then to fool yourself. Because you in personalizing the issue, you are blinding yourself to the actual complexities of the situation. And this has been a recurring problem for us throughout this war for the greater Middle East, of not taking on board the context in which military action is taking place.
Well, just in closing, Colonel Basevich, let me put you on the spot in terms of, you know, we all find ourselves spending a lot of time criticizing how screwed up things are, but solutions are hard to come by. Identifying the problem is usually easier. I know in your book you've called for the demilitarization of U.S. policy in the Middle East, but give us some of your suggestions of how we might proceed in a better, more humane, and less costly manner.
Well, we should demilitarize U.S. policy because it's not working. We should demilitarize U.S. policy in light of a realistic understanding of the threat to the United States. People are in something akin to a panic about ISIS, but ISIS does not pose a serious threat to American security. And to the extent that there is a threat from entities like ISIS, the proper response is self-protection, to properly resource and ensure that there's effective leadership for our internal security agencies, whether we're talking about the TSA or the Coast Guard or the FBI or border agencies. Keep the bad guys out. You can't do that perfectly, but you can certainly do it enough to maintain our overall safety. With regard to the region itself, and in particular, the core of the Middle East, where the new caliphate has gained some purchase, I think that the issue there is to the imperative there is to get the parties of the region who are threatened by ISIS in a profound way, to get them to collaborate with one another to solve that problem. Because if the states like Saudi Arabia, Iran, Iraq, Turkey made common cause against ISIS, they could rather easily dispatch ISIS in my view. That presumes that those countries who disagree with one another on a wide variety of issues could suspend those disagreements in order to collaborate against a common threat. And I think that's the diplomatic task facing the United States, to get those countries to recognize that they have a profound common interest in collaborating against a particular threat. So, and the point of describing that is not to say that it would be easy, but to make the point that there are alternatives to simply continuing down the military path that we have followed.
And of course, the refugee flows, which are clearly caused by these wars in Iraq, Syria, and Afghanistan, would that suggest then that the Europeans, who are bearing the brunt of the refugee problem, do they have to also get smarter and pony up?
Well, they're going to have to get smarter, but I mean, on the Syrian refugees, we too have a responsibility. I mean, we contributed to the circumstance that has created the anarchy that exists in the region. So I think it's frankly shameful that the United States has been so unwilling to accept refugees from the Syrian civil war. You know, when we compare our efforts to those of Germany, we look pretty pathetic.
Even Canada,
right
next door. Well, I thank you very much for joining us, Andrew Bacevich. I appreciate the conversation.
Thanks a lot.
And again, I've been speaking with Andrew Bacevich. He's a retired professor of history and international relations at Boston University, who previously taught at West Point and Johns Hopkins University. A graduate of the U.S. Military Academy, he served for 23 years as a commissioned officer in the United States Army and is the author of the New York Times bestsellers Breach of Trust, Washington Rules, and The Limits of Power. His latest book just out is America's War for the Greater Middle East, A Military History. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into whether Ted Cruz might turn out to be a stalking horse for the more electable Paul Ryan.
Find the cause of freedom buried in the ground.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Matt Engel, who directs the Texas Democratic Trust and the Lone Star Project, a political action committee that aims to be an aggressive fact checker on the Republican Party, both at the state and national levels. Matt Engel has served as executive director of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, and from 2000 to 2004 was executive director of the House Democratic Caucus. Welcome to Background Briefing, Matt Engel.
It's great to be with you, Ian. Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Matt. And following Ted Cruz's resounding victory in Wisconsin, now he's not only the head of the Stop Trump movement, but he's looking as though he might actually be a possible GOP nominee for president of the United States. Obviously, he's going to have to get past Trump at the convention, and Trump would presumably show up with a considerable lead in delegates, but not necessarily the number, the 1237 number, the magic number that he wants or requires to get the nomination on the first ballot. So let's begin with that hypothetical, that presumably if Cruz becomes the Republican nominee, he's going to be bruised, because isn't there going to be a bruising battle at that convention in Cleveland?
Oh, I think it'll be a brutal fight. And if Cruz comes out as the nominee, it means that he will probably have taken it away from the candidate who had the most delegates going in. It will mean that he will have somehow allied himself with the powers that be in the Republican Party, some of them establishment and some of them not, in order to wrest it away from Trump. I think that the feelings will be very, very bitter. And Now, I will tell you, having known Cruz for quite some time and having seen him operate, I don't think that will personally faze him at all. He seems to not have any reluctance at all to offend people or to bruise other people in order to get his way. But I think that it will be a brutal and ugly fight.
But, you know, I detect that quality in him, even though I've not met him and I can only make this basis on seeing lots of footage of him, that he sort of seems immune in a way to the broader reality of the fact that throughout his political career, as much as we know of it, because it's been fairly brief, he has been uncompromisingly far right wing. And all of the political wisdom and conventions tell you that you can, you know, you move to the right in the primaries, but you got to move back to the center in the general. And that he seems to be completely either oblivious of that or immune to it. Do you think he's capable of being a brazen chameleon and just suddenly turning on a dime and being?
I don't think he's capable of doing that on issues. I think he really is somebody who sees his future tied up with really adhering to the farthest right, most extreme positions. I mean, keep in mind, on the key issues, there's no daylight between him and Donald Trump. Ted Cruz is also for building a wall. He's also for sending federal troops out to round up undocumented immigrants. He's also for canceling the Affordable Care Act and eliminating health care for millions of Americans. I mean, he was one of only eight senators who voted against the reauthorization of the Violence Against Women's Act, which is a program to help women who have been domestically abused. And he's uncompromising as it relates to issues. Now, at the same time, on matters that relate to politics, he's totally calculating and has no loyalties. I mean, I think he'd sell out his best friend for one more delegate. The three Texas politicians that know him best and have worked most closely with him, their reactions to him are really telling. One of them is George W. Bush. Cruz worked for George W. Bush, worked in his White House, also worked on the recount committee when he was getting elected. George W. Bush says very flatly that he just doesn't like the guy. The current governor of Texas, Greg Abbott, who made Cruz his solicitor general, he didn't endorse Cruz until just days before the Texas primary. Half the vote had already been cast during early vote, and he still hadn't endorsed Cruz. And then John Cornyn, who is Cruz's counterpart in the U.S. Senate, who is his senior senator, still won't endorse him. And in fact has said that he'll even campaign for Donald Trump if Donald Trump is the nominee. He has not made it clear that he would campaign for Ted Cruz if he's the nominee. And so while Cruz is unbending and inflexible on right-wing ideological issues, he's absolutely calculating, untrustworthy on personal political matters.
And again, I'm speaking with Matt Engel, who directs the Texas Democratic Trust and the Lone Star Project, a political action committee that aims to be an aggressive fact-checker on the Republican Party, both at the state and national levels. Matt Engel has served as executive director of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee and from 2000 to 2004 was executive director of the House Democratic Caucus. So you've just told us, Matt, that the top politicians on the Republican side in the state of Texas, the former president and governor, George W. Bush, the current senior senator, and the current governor all don't like him. But you have to add to that list that the fact that his Senate Republican colleagues and indeed his Democratic colleagues in the House, maybe colleagues is not the right word, in the Senate clearly dislike him. He is the least popular member. I can't remember which senator said that if Cruz was assassinated on the floor of the Senate, there'd be no witnesses. And more recently, Senator Lindsey Graham, who reluctantly endorsed him, said the choice between Donald Trump and Ted Cruz is the choice between being shot or being poisoned.
Well, it's a little bit like we say in Texas, he's about as popular as head lice. I mean, nobody wants to be around him. And he's one of those politicians, too, that he drips with insincerity. He's always looking to make new friends because he doesn't have any old ones. His ambition is foremost, and his history has shown that he will sacrifice everybody else's interest to promote his own. Now, I will tell you, Ian, I think that something that would be important if he did become the nominee is to keep in mind that as a politician, even though he's calculating and shrewd, he's not very experienced. He's only run for high office one other time when he ran for the U.S. Senate in 2012. He won a very low turnout, uneventful Republican primary. And so he's never really been tested by a real strong opponent, particularly somebody like Hillary Clinton, who would not for one second be intimidated by his negative countenance or his mean spirit. And so I think he would struggle as the Republican general election nominee. I don't know that he would be that much better option for Republicans than Trump, to tell you the truth.
But apparently he's running a pretty good and professional campaign, much more so than Trump. And Trump's apparently come to the party late in terms of keeping his eye on the delegates. And he's been winging it all along, it seems. And perhaps even Trump didn't take it seriously until he realized that he was getting so much support. But clearly, in Cruz's case, he's driven by a kind of blind ambition.
Oh, absolutely, and you can't underestimate Cruz because, again, he's very calculating, and the broad Republican Party interests have at least for the time being decided that Cruz is the best way to stop Trump. I mean, Cruz has more supporters, more support from people that don't like him than any politician I've ever seen. So the question is, how will that play into the convention? Is it possible that Republicans really are just now using him as a stalking horse to overcome Trump and then turn to somebody else at the convention, or if he is their nominee, they execute what I hear some people call a lose with Cruz strategy, in which they turn all their resources to trying to hold on to their down ballot races, recognizing that Cruz would not be a strong candidate in the fall. I guess this time will figure that out, I guess.
Well, the question would be, in terms of the down ballot damage, whether he would be much better than Trump. I mean, the senators who know him better, they're the ones that were appalled by his opposition that led to the 2013 government shutdown and his attempt to kill the Affordable Care Act and making his colleagues come back to work on a Saturday at the last minute in a grandstanding and futile effort to stop Obama's immigration actions from going into effect. So I don't know. I mean, you'd have to ask them, but aren't the 24 or 26 Republican senators going to have a hard time if Cruz is at the top of the ticket defending the guy they hate and at the same time being terrified that he's going to take him down? They're going to go down with him?
Oh, I don't think there's any question that they're having to choose the lesser of what they think is the lesser of two evils. But I think it's Jerry Garcia that said that the thing to remember when you're choosing between evils, it's still evil. And Cruz would be a drag, but he would not be the same drag that Trump would be. Trump's negatives are so high, and particularly the animosity that Latino voters and women voters feel for him. I think that Trump would just be a disaster for Republicans down ballot. Cruz, again, I think would not be helpful to them, but he probably wouldn't be as negative a force. And also, I don't think they'll bat an eye about pulling resources away from Cruz to protect themselves. I think that goes to their feeling no personal loyalty or affection to him, and so I don't think he would have the same level of support or the same call on resources that a Republican nominee who has better relationships would have.
And again, I'm speaking with Matt Engel, who directs the Texas Democratic Trust and the Lone Star Project, a political action committee that aims to be an aggressive fact-checker on the Republican Party, both at the state and national levels. Matt Engel has served as executive director of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee and from 2000 to 2004 was executive director of the House Democratic Caucus. Well, what you just mentioned, though, Matt Engel, the idea that Cruz maybe uses a stalking horse to stop Trump, who has clearly alarmed the so-called Republican establishment, which is, it's not entirely clear what that is, what that means anymore. But nevertheless, it's pretty clear that there is a Stop Trump movement and that his function would be to stop him and then they'd find somebody better. And everybody seems to be thinking now that that's Paul Ryan. And Paul Ryan, of course, was very coy, waiting in the wings when he resisted taking the speakership, but eventually did. And it's almost like that movie is being repeated now, where he keeps saying, no, 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 I'm not running and I shouldn't be the nominee, etc. It has a kind of echo of his earlier coyness. So would that be who you would have in mind or that they might have in mind if that is the scenario, to use Cruz to stop Trump and then once he's used, throw him away and get somebody? Because my sense about the Republicans, where they differ from the Democrats, and you're better to answer this than anybody, you know, it's as though the Democrats in 72 sort of took a bye with McGovern and to some extent also with Dukakis and Mondale, but they protected the House and Senate. I don't see that in the Republicans. They seem to always want to win, and I'd be surprised if the Republican Party decided to take a bye, which I don't think they've ever done, really. Maybe they did with Gerald Ford when they thought Ronald Reagan was the better candidate in 76, but it doesn't seem to be in their nature. So start with that, if you don't mind.
Well, I think you're right. I think that the Republicans have always been able to be a little bit more disciplined and really be able to lock in decisions to protect their long-term interests. As Democrats, again, we tend to think in terms of issues and rather than consolidation of power. I think now that Republicans have so much fanned the flames of anger and inflexibility within their party and a lack of tolerance that I think it could be getting away from them at the delegate level. And so the question is whether they could really enforce discipline in a convention, or will they, in trying to take it away from Cruz or Trump and give it to a third person, whether they will really just dissolve their party. I think that they're going to have to determine whether it's worth the risk.
But the whole purpose of conventions is, you know, nominally to find the person who's going to lead you to victory. And in the middle of all of these battles that are all but inevitable now, you know, my sense is that maybe at the end of the day, that would be their focus rather than limiting damage and damage control.
Well, I think you could be right. I mean, if you're a Republican and you're thinking in a real cold way, you realize that you've got majorities in the House and you've got majorities in the Senate, and that those are that significant power, and you don't want to cede that power if you don't have a chance to win the presidency. And so I think that if they saw that there was a real risk of losing particularly their House majority, which would be a disaster for them, they could lose the Senate majority, but because of the supermajority rule, still be obstructionist. But if they lost their majority in the House, it would be a disaster for them. And so they may be in a situation where they decide that will be their priority rather than risking losing it all by nominating somebody that would be such a drag down ballot.
So would you agree then, Matt Engel, that Paul Ryan is their best hope?
Oh, well, he's certainly a better option, I would think, than Cruz or Trump. I mean, while on specific issues, he's far to the right, he doesn't have the persona. He doesn't have the nature that is so divisive. He's more vanilla pudding than I think seen as less threatening. And so that would be a safer way for them to go, I would think, unless the wild card is whether or not they really had a revolt at their convention, whether it forced, whether Trump ended up going, running as a third party and being able to get on the ballot in enough states to be disruptive.
And that's increasingly unlikely. But on the other hand, just in closing, Matt Engel, you can't discount the possibility a week from today in New York, Trump will make a comeback, and then in Pennsylvania do the same thing. There's still an outside chance, right, that they can get to the 1-2-3-7 delegates?
Absolutely. I mean, right now it looks like he would win New York rather handily, and he's slightly ahead in Pennsylvania. And if he goes to the convention, and let's say he doesn't have a majority, but he's within 30 or 40 delegates, or even within 100 delegates, again, it becomes a pretty dramatic and drastic move for the Republican Party to step in and do what it would take to deny him the nomination. Now, as you mentioned before, they're very calculating, and they do a better job of protecting their power, really, than Democrats do. So it wouldn't shock me, but I think it would be hard. And there's no reason to believe now that Trump won't get close to the majority, even if he doesn't get it.
Well, Matt Engel, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Matt Engel, who directs the Texas Democratic Trust and the Lone Star Project, a political action committee that aims to be an aggressive fact-checker on the Republican Party, both at the state and national levels. Matt Engel has served as executive director of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, and from 2000 to 2004, he was the executive director of the House Democratic Caucus. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. Where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Bye.